So I have a cold open for you this week based on one of my favorite songs in this musical, which is What Is This Feeling? So most of you probably remember the line of like loathing, pure unadulterated loathing. So it's their like, their little battle song of when they first realize they're not friends. But it makes me, well, I think one, we've all had some kind of experience where you just meet someone and you instantly dislike them and you don't really know why, which is part of why I love the song. But what I want to know, and you can change the name if you want, who was your nemesis in high school?
God
You know?
damn. I actually don't know if I had an enemy. I feel like this is not going to be a great answer. I didn't have a lot of like enemies in high school. I think I was pretty quiet, surprisingly. I was also very religious at that point in my life.
So you were much nicer than you are now, is
Oh
what you're
yeah,
saying.
I'm like a debaucherous deviant at this point. But no, I didn't really have too many enemies in high school. I'm trying to think, honestly, if anybody comes to
Or middle
mind.
school, like when do you, or somebody that if I say that, I mean, I assume not in your adult life very much, right? But like, if I say that, who comes to mind?
My first, actually, maybe college. I really disliked my first college roommate. We
Really?
just butted
Ooh.
heads on like day two and just did not get along. It was just a stupid back and forth, like prank wars, but not in a fun way. It was really just trying to like annoy the shit
Like
out of each other.
malicious prank wars.
To the point that basically, I hate using the term bullying, but again, I was 17 years old. So we frankly bullied this dude because he was an asshole, and eventually he moved out. So I got a single for 6 months, which was
You
nice.
bullied him out of your room, which, let's be honest, is what Galindo wishes would have happened here. But yeah, damn, that's an accomplishment. That is
Bullying
an
somebody out of a
accomplishment.
dorm room.
I mean, yeah, that this is used to do some shit, I feel like, at that point.
I feel like
No.
partially justified because that dude rubbed a lot of people the wrong way. He actually ended up like leaving campus after a year. All the people that were friends with him stopped being friends with him. So I was like, I feel like I came out looking better in that scenario. The ends justify the means kind of thing.
Then this makes it sound. Yeah. Okay. Fair enough. Mine is definitely like, I was actually the same as you in high school. I didn't really have any like, I had lots of friends in lots of different groups in high school. I wouldn't say I was popular, Galinda style, but I was comfortable with my number of friends. I don't think I had anybody that like super disliked me or vice versa. But in middle school, like and I've said this before on the pod, like middle school for girls, I think is so much worse than high school. At least that was certainly my experience, and a number of women I know that was also their experience.
I think that's 110% right. And I think just in general, I think for some reason, I'm not trying to, lump everybody together, but it just seems like, Mean Girls was, there's a reason they didn't make the Mean Boys movie. It's like girls tend to butt heads when they're going through that coming of age. Guys might have a fist fight, but it always seems like the next week they're friends again. It's strange.
And I definitely think it's more in middle school because you're going through the most, I would say, traumatic changes at that time, honestly, at least for me. Like, I remember, so mine is this girl. I'll call her out. I don't give a shit. Her name's Kristen. She was an asshole. And I
The
really
Kristen
wanted to be.
Chenoweth, who went on to be in the on.
No, we would not dishonor her this way. Actually, I think they did spell it. No, they spelled it slightly different. I think. I don't remember. Anyway, we had a lot of Kristens. It's like the basic bitch name of middle school, I guess. But anyway, she was the fucking worst, is the point. And but I was at that age where like I wanted to be friends with her, and I wanted to be friends with all of her friends was part of it. And also, I was that kid who wanted to be friends with everybody. I at this time, you wouldn't believe it today, was a hyper social person who wanted to be friends with everyone. And so I was like, I did not know why this girl didn't like me. I was a very likable girl. I don't understand. And she was just a dick. And they would like pull pranks on me. They invited me to things to just like not show up. They like invited me to a party one time and like tried to bully me into kissing this boy that I didn't like. You know what I mean? Just petty, like girly de things and like stupid stuff on a lunch day of like, you can't sit with us unless you do, blah, blah, blah. And it's some ridiculous, embarrassing thing, you know? And I just thought, there's nothing that inspires me to treat anybody this way. Like I would never think of this on my own. I would never think to put someone through this gauntlet, you know, of my actual friends. And yeah, she was just that kind of person. And she just kind of like thought she was so much cooler than everyone else. So yeah, she was my nemesis, but unlike this, not turned bestie, never turned bestie at all.
I used to witness that a lot in as a middle school teacher was students, hating each other's guts, and then a week later they're best friends. It happens more often than you would think. Or the
opposite. I did have that with one girl. This girl, Lauren, she and I are actually still friends, like Facebook friends now, but like we're still friends to this day. This girl, Lauren, and I, hi Lauren, if you're listening, had a big fight in middle school that was like, the school watched us have this fight. Like we threw down. It was like all the middle school girls were like around us. I don't even remember, you know, what a middle school girls fight about. I have no idea. I don't even know what we were fighting about, but we had a big blowout fight. And then I think it literally was like a week or two later, we made up and we were friends ever since. It was wild. That's girls are wild at that age.
Yeah. I wish I could contribute more to this conversation. I think, you know, if I did have enemies, I guess they're so far in the past. My old ass doesn't remember them. So.
He's like, everybody loved me, actually. Anyway.
There are, though, what I was going to say, to your point about, like, you know, you wanted to be liked by everybody. I have that similar personality trait where, like,
yeah.
I want to make conversation. I feel like I can connect with anybody. And there are people who really don't like that type of person who it's like,
yeah, oh, that's
tried.
True.
So they will put you through the ringer because they're like, dude, I see what you're trying. To me, it doesn't feel
they'll put you through the gauntlet.
But, like, they're like you, I get what you're doing. Yeah. I don't need to be friends with you. So I guess I get it.
I mean, I'm still like that. Like, it's funny. I have this horrible dichotomy now of I want everyone to like me, but I want to hate like 50% of you because I'm not a fan. So that's unreasonable, obviously. But I'm in sales. You have to find a way to get along with everybody. And ultimately, I do typically. But yeah, I have this for such an asshole. I have an absurd need to be liked. So
you know, like that the Ryan Seacrest syndrome, I guess. You know?
Is that what we would call it?
I don't know.
Okay, I don't know if I want to be associated with that. We'll move right past that. But anyways, all right, on to the good stuff. Thanks for playing. Welcome back to We Drink and We Watch Things. I'm Mackenzie, Wicked Edition. Okay.
I'm La-Mar. There's a in there, but maybe I'll shorten it by the end of the pod.
Out of solidarity to something, you know, for sure. So if you can't tell, we're doing Wicked. If you're watching this, you can super tell. Also, you probably read the title of the episode, obviously. But I am dressed up. I have a hat. I have eye makeup on, which I never wear. I've got green earrings. I've got props that y'all are going to see in a minute. Like we're fucking ready to go.
I'm wearing a pink shirt. I think I own one pink shirt. So that
we've committed happening. To our respective roles, you know, the Elphabas and the Galindas of the world happening here. Yeah. Yeah. This is part of Oscars month. We should clarify. So, you know, we are going to spend February kicking off some nominations. We're going to go through just a handful, obviously. I will simultaneously be trying to watch them all, as I always do. But we wanted to talk about this one today because we know, I mean, most of y'all have probably seen this by now. This is a big one.
And for those that don't know out there, when you say see them all, Mackenzie is literally talking about every single movie that gets any Oscar nomination, not just Best Picture, not just Best Actor, every single film.
Yeah. If you're new here, it's a big project that I do every year. I think, gosh, I'm going to have to listen to last year's episode because I think I had the count right. This is the sixth or seventh year I will have done it. And it is. It's a fucking odyssey. So you guys will get updates and you'll get to hear about some of them. But yeah, it's usually like 50-ish films. 45 to 55 films seems to be the range. So
yeah, we'll only be able to cover like four of them, obviously, this month. But I'm curious to hear from you as the weeks go on and you're watching all these other side ones, which ones you'd recommend to the listeners and whatnot.
Well, if it's not clear, I would definitely recommend this one. So we'll get into it. But to power us through this one, in addition to committing to our costumes, we also committed to our drinks. So what are you drinking?
We did two different drinks today. We went with one for each main character. It felt very fitting. So this one is pretty much just, I mean, it's a pretty standard Cosmo. I did 2 ounces. I like to use Citroen vodka when I do Cosmos, not just straight vodka. Half an ounce of Cointreau, 0.75 ounces of lime. I do an ounce of cranberry. Some people might think that's too much. But what I did to make this special for Galinda herself is rather than putting any extra sweetener or simple in there, I did a sugar rim, which is, you know, very me. And the color on this is perfect. It is just the exact color pink of her dress. So I'm very excited about it. And we're calling this Popular Potion.
First of all, this is so on brand because Lamar literally yesterday, we had lunch for a friend's birthday yesterday, literally had a cocktail that was kind of pinkish and also had a sugar rim. So you just committed to the bit rim. two days in a row.
Yeah.
I turned to him, y'all, and I was like, what did you order? Sugar rim.
On brand.
I was like, checks out.
All right. What about you? What did you whip up? I wasn't even privy to the recipe for this one. So what'd you end up with?
I wasn't privy to it either until it was like being made. So I just made the request that it not involve Midori, but somehow still be green.
We wanted green.
So yeah. So it is in fact green. This is Alpha Buzzed, which I think was an excellent name coined by Mr. Lamar here. We built the recipe, but he gave such great names. Actually, I had a hard time picking, but that was my favorite one. But yeah, so this is 2 ounces of bourbon, 1/2 ounce ginger liqueur, 1/2 ounce limoncello, 1/4 ounce blue carousel, and 3/4 ounce of honey syrup, squeeze in 1/2 a lemon. And then we added a fun little garnish of a little pineapple wedge.
Oh, that is like the perfect color. There is a lot going on in there.
There is, but it's beautiful. But also I haven't tried it yet. So cheers. Let's find out how it is.
Cheers.
Okay, that is delicious. You would love this.
Actually. What is it like? What's it going? Because I've never mixed ginger liqueur. And what was the third thing you said?
Limoncello.
Yeah, limoncello liqueur, and ginger liqueur. Yeah. I've never had those two in the same drink, so I'm curious.
Yeah, it's very good, actually. It's very sweet. It's a little bit sweeter than I would normally drink, but I do like it. And you would love it, I think, honestly. So, yeah, you guys should try this one. It's delicious. And yes, the color is perfect. I was going to put it in my Wicked cup from when I saw Wicked on Broadway, one of the 4 times I've seen it on Broadway, actually. But it was so pretty in that I couldn't take it out. So this is my water cup today instead. But yeah, I brought, like I said, I'll be showing off my props as we go along.
I was going to say eagle-eyed viewers on YouTube are going to love watching me pick sugar out of my mustache today. So that's going to be a fun little thing for the video watchers. But I wanted to get a real quick still frame. Can you hold your drink up? I just want to
get the
visual of these two awesome drinks that we have. So
beautiful.
Very cool.
Very cool. Beautiful. Thanks to @CraftWorld once again.
As always, yeah.
When I need to be no vowels. Don't get it twisted. Who needs them? Okay, so we are cocktailed. We are ready to go. We are going to talk about this gem. We will do a little spoiler-free because, again, this is a 2024 Oscar nominee and recent film that I do think a lot of y'all have seen, but perhaps not everyone. So let's do some basics, shall we? So as we said, this last year, this came out. The ratings are pretty solid. To be honest, I thought they would be a little higher, but it's fine. 7.7 out of 10 on IMDb. 88% for critics on Rotten Tomatoes. That's the one I was more upset about, to be honest. And then the 95% for audiences. So very well received from audiences, I would say.
What if the critics, the 12% that aren't there, if it's just not musical fans or if it's they're such big fans? Because I feel like everyone involved in the stage performance of this in the original run has praised it as an adaptation. Mm-hmm. So like, yeah. I can't imagine that's too much of that 12%. So maybe they're just not their style of movie.
I think some people are genuinely not just not musical people. I will say everyone that I have spoken to, including a friend and former guest star of the pod, Taylor, who are not musical people, were converts to this musical. Like, they loved this particular show. And I think Wicked is one of those musicals, and that is why it's been so wildly successful on Broadway, running over 20 years, because it is so well received. It is so consumable for most audiences, and it's got this like just adjacent subject matter to the story that everybody knows, you know. So
it benefits heavily from that. It is incredible. Like, it's very good. I've only seen the musical once. I remember the beginning being a little slow, but once it got into building toward and incorporating all these Easter eggs and references and showing you, you know, more than just them at school and whatnot, like, that's when I sort of got on board with it. So but it benefits heavily from being a musical that is steeped in this other story that we all are very familiar with from when we were kids and watching the movie, you know?
Yeah, 100%. And I think, like, again, you guys know I've said before that I love the actual original source material from, you know, many of these books, and this is no exceptions, like Wonderful Wizard of Oz and that whole series is really, and actually I feel like I've brought that out before when we talked about some of the inspiration for some of these other things. But anyway, it's a really good source material. But what is the actual source material of this musical is a kind of a reimagining, if you didn't already know. And we won't, don't worry, we won't spoil plot. But this book, which is Wicked, and this is by Gregory Maguire. It's the source material for the book. And by book, I mean the musical book. And it's kind of a reimagining of Wizard of Oz, essentially, of like what happened before Dorothy dropped in. And that's kind of the tagline, right? And I think I've read this like a half dozen times. It's so good. And it just retells the story from the perspective of Elphaba and Glinda in school, essentially. So
yeah. I wanted to, you've said it twice now, but I wanted to point something out to folks of, I assume a lot of people who see this movie will have already seen the full musical. If for some reason you haven't and you just decided you wanted to go see Wicked over Christmas break, just be forewarned, the IMDb trivia, like I was doing a little bit of research for today's ep, it's just ruining the entire musical, which again, I assume most people have seen the full thing.
Yeah.
But if you're waiting to see the musical until after you see part two, it's going to give away a lot of the stuff happening there. So
yeah,
I assume we're just going to talk about part one today for the most part.
Yeah, we're definitely going to just talk about part one. We're not going to go into what happens in they're calling it Wicked for Good. So the part two will be called For Good. But we're not talking about that one today. We're just going to take us to the break point, which in the musical is intermission anyway. So
yes,
it works out. Okay, so some other basics. The director who decided to take this on is Mr. John M. Chu, and he is no stranger to musicals, did In the Heights, the adaptation on film as well. He has also done Crazy Rich Asians, which I think is like a funny, fun rom-com a lot of people have seen, was also very successful. And most importantly, Step Up to the Streets.
I thought you were in a different direction there, because another one he did that we talked about, I think 3 weeks ago, was G.I. Joe,
like G.I. Joe Retaliation. Yes.
The guy from The Mummy didn't. That's who it was, right? Am I mixing things up? Was it the guy from The Mummy?
I think that's a different guy, but yes, this, we did talk about a G.I. Joe sequel. You know,
yeah, I'm trying to remember like who it was, but it was like, oh, this person did the first G.I. Joe, but did not get a callback for Retaliation. Yeah. John Chu came in and apparently did a better job than the first one. So we're never going to cover G.I. Joe on this podcast, but it's been mentioned at least twice.
We're also never going to cover Step Up to the Streets. Let's be honest. We might cover Step Up One. Listen, I loved it. I thought it was a good time. Anyway,
you're
moving
a purist,
right along.
Yeah. I'm a purist, we never needed to go down to the streets.
We didn't, you know. And speaking again of the source material, like I said, the book itself, Wicked by Gregory Maguire, but the musical source material is Stephen Schwartz, who did the music for the musical, and then Winnie Holtzman, who did the book. So if you're unfamiliar with like stage terms, when somebody's creating a musical, there's typically a lyricist, composer, person who does the music, and oftentimes a person who does the book. And that is a different type of writer. And usually it's a duo in a lot of cases. Sometimes they're slightly different. Sometimes there is one person, but rarely is that the same person. And then they added for the film Dana Fox, who is a screenwriter specifically, who you can see kind of a few things where she would have had an impact to kind of translate it from stage to screen. And then I want to get into some of the music stuff, because of course it is a musical, but this is a little bit more than we would typically dive into, because there's a lot of involvement here. So for the film, so like translating from stage to film, so obviously Stephen Schwartzman again did the score, did the songs of the original. We also have John Powell, who is a film composer, who did an incidental underscore. So that's something that you kind of like hear underlaying throughout. That's not necessarily original source material.
Like he just stumbled
Stephen
into
Schwartz.
The studio and something happened and they were like, oh, yeah, just leave that
fell
in. It's
out
incidental
of him.
Underscore.
Yeah,
you know.
Totally an accident. 100%. Yeah. But he complements it really well. I think if you're a fan of the musical and you've seen it before, it doesn't stand out as being wildly different. I think it does complement the original score. And he took the orchestra from 23 musicians, which is what it is on Broadway, to 125. So the incidental underscores quite a bit more musicians. And actually, like, he's not the orchestrator. I forget their names. There's a lot of people involved in that side of it, but they did grow that musician pool a little bit. And then Stephen Aramis, actually, fun fact, this is just a fun one I wanted to share with y'all, was the original musical director on Broadway. And he actually conducted the original score when they recorded this for the film as well. So they brought him back among some others as well. There are some original cast chorus members who record the ensemble pieces, and they're from the original Wicked cast as well. So pretty cool.
I think it was smart of them to involve as many people from the original stage run and all that as they could, not just have the blessing of, you know, the super passionate audience for this. But yeah, just it's a good way to call back and give credit to, you know, the things that came before you, essentially, like the people that paved the way for you to make this film. So smart to involve all of them.
Yeah, 100%. And I like, so to give more color to my nerddom, I actually saw this in the original run with my best friend. We were theater kids and long, you know, theater kid alumni. And so one of my best friends to this day, we saw it with the OG cast. And this was just like, and this was my first experience on Broadway too. So I had never been to Broadway. I'd never been to New York. And I think this was maybe the second musical I saw on Broadway during that trip, but it was just mind-blowing. You know, it's the most beautiful thing you've ever seen, especially as a, what, I don't know, 13-year-old, 14-year-old theater kid who is just sobbing with, you know, dreams and everything. And so I had this protectiveness over it because of this. And so I was very excited about them making a film, but also really nervous about it for all the reasons. And one of the props I wanted to bring but could not track down was the original playbill. I think it's in storage. I need to find it. But the original playbill of when I first saw it, because I have kept it to this day.
How did you feel when you heard that they were splitting the play into two films? Because it's like it could go either way. I understand, you know, the musical itself, the original stage play is, what, 3.5 hours? So it kind of had to be split into two. But then when I heard, oh, this first one's going to be almost 3 hours, so they're adding length as well as splitting it. What were your thoughts on that? Because I feel like that's a dangerous game sometimes.
Well, so like as an audience member who just wants the instant gratification, I was bummed because you want to see the whole thing, right? Mm-hmm. But as a fan of the source material, I was like, yeah, makes sense. You know, it kind of makes sense, because I actually would defer to Stephen Schwartz's quote on this when he was asked about it. He was like, the middle number, which we'll get into, you know, no spoilers, is a number that is intended to bring the curtain down. Like, that's the point. Yeah. Things after that will feel anticlimactic if you try to put it in a movie, because it's the climax. And then you've got this like denouement, and it's going to feel like there's a different weird breakpoint if we move it. And I was totally in agreement with that.
I can't imagine.
I was bummed when I watched it because I was like, I just want to see the rest. But
yeah, I can't imagine cut like a hard cut from that last number and the moment there to like, now she's having coffee in a cafe.
Right.
Thinking her next move. Like, you know, there's not a lot you can do to follow that up.
Hard place to transition. Yeah. I think it is fair to say for sure. Okay, well, let's get into some cast and crew here. We got a hats off to, pun intended, our leader here, Miss Elphaba, played by Cynthia Erivo, who I have talked about on the pod before. I'm pretty sure I fangirled in the past on her, but if you don't recall, she was the lead in Harriet, played Harriet Tubman, also sang in that film for unrelated reasons. It's not a musical. And wrote and performed that song, Stand Up, that it's most well known for. Also was nominated for an Oscar, fun fact. She's just a bad bitch. She's so fucking good, man. She has also done, if it's not clear, she's been on Broadway. She was on the West End, which, if you don't know what that is like the London version of Broadway. She's a British actress. And she also did, fun fact, Strange Planet, which is based on a really nerdy alien comic series that I like. So she does a voice on that. If you,
I liked her in Bad Times at the El Royale. Did you see that one?
I did see that, but it's been a while, and I was trying to remember which one she was. But I did see that. I just don't remember.
She was the main girl. I think it was her, and was it?
Yeah,
Jeff
and
Bridges
I saw that years ago. I think before I had ever seen her in anything else. You know what I mean?
I get the critique of it. It is kind of trying to be like a Tarantino-esque film with like these zany characters and the witty repartee, and it doesn't quite ever get there, but I thought it was enjoyable. I liked it.
It was fun. I remember it being a fun watch, but yeah, I don't remember it being like amazing. I do. Yeah, I remember feeling like this is trying to be something different, and it's not quite doing it.
Also,
but
you want a little stat that is, I mean, a compliment to Miss Erivo, but also kind of depressing.
What? Yeah, hit me.
One of only 11 Black actresses to ever be nominated for Best Actress, which is insanely low, but a credit to her. But it's like we gotta do a little better here.
I mean, if you're just listening to this and not watching this, the eye roll that nearly fell out of my head at that, I fucking hate that. And yeah, 11. Again, credit to her. 11. Credit to her. She's fucking amazing. But there have been many, many amazing Black actresses on the screen that have probably deserved that as well. So I'm excited for her this year for all the reasons. She did, again, get a lot of attention for Harriet. But I love how much even more this is putting her on the map, because she's just wildly talented. Ariana Grande, we all know her, right? Playing Galinda. Glinda, don't get it twisted. She changes her name.
The Good Witch, right?
The Good Witch.
We all remember she's the good one, yeah.
She's the good one, obviously. I'll personally take a wicked one myself. But I think what I would say is that Ariana Grande is like not my cup of tea, so I don't know most of her thing. Like, I don't know her song repertoire. I don't know her, you know, TV. She did a ton of Nickelodeon and all those kinds of kid TV shows. She also did do Don't Look Up, which is more recent.
Yeah, she's playing like a pop star in that. She was good.
Yeah, but she's, you know, she's fucking talented as well. You know, she's got an incredible voice. Like, her music may not necessarily be my music, but she has an incredible voice. And one of the things that stood out to me years ago was she went on, I want to say it was like a Jimmy Fallon or something like that, and they had her do impressions of a bunch of other amazing singers, like an Adele, like a Mariah Carey, like a Celine Dion, whatever. And she fucking nailed it. She nailed every single one. So credit where it's due. She's not just a pop star. She's got some fucking pipes.
Yeah, I think if they had fucked up the casting in this, it could have gone really bad. I think Ariana Grande brings a lot. I think she's also very funny. Again, I'm not same as you. I'm not experienced with a ton of her work.
Kid, but, you know, Nickelodeon days, like comedy chops. Yeah,
she just has moments in this of great comedic timing and like physical comedy, just over the top. And I know some of it, you know, we're not going to give 100% of the credit to the people playing these characters that have existed for 2 decades. Like, I get it. The character has already existed. Let's get that out of the way.
I think
purists.
With Ariana Grande, we can a little bit, though. She's,
you know,
doing it on
hair
purpose.
Whips and like the thing where she throws herself on the bed dramatically. She's doing these little things that are very, very fun.
Oh, for sure. And I would say, quick sidebar here. I mean, it's been covered and covered and covered, so you've probably already heard the story, guys. But Kristen Chenoweth was the OG, Glinda, and absolute legend on Broadway and off. And she and Ariana Grande met when Ariana Grande was like 8 or 9 on Broadway. She went backstage at Wicked, met Kristen Chenoweth. Don't ask me why that was able to happen or why they kept in touch afterward, but they did. So she impressed her to the degree that she stayed in touch with her and followed her. So she has deep, deep respect and abiding love for Kristen Chenoweth and her version of Glinda. And if you have seen her version of Glinda, this is an homage to that. She's not trying to radically change the game. Like, she does put a little bit of her spin on it, but that physical comedy. And so like that is Kristen Chenoweth in this role. Yeah. And I think it's totally okay to say that she's like, I'm playing this character. She actually, Stephen Schwartz was like going to change one of her songs for her to be more poppy, hip hoppy. And she was like, no, I don't want this to be Ariana Grande playing Glinda. Like,
she's
I'm
as much
Glinda
of a purist as like you and the fans.
Fuck yeah,
are.
She is. Yeah. Cause she saw it when she was 8 or 9 on Broadway. She gets it. So yeah, respect. I love her renditions here for sure. Jeff Goldblum, who again, we've talked about a bazillion times, but he plays the wonderful Wizard of Oz, and he is so appropriately cast for this role. Obviously done a million things. Jurassic Park, The Fly, Chaos he did recently, which I really liked on Netflix. If you haven't seen it, it did get canceled, but it was really good. Yeah, he's just a gem. He's really perfect for this, I think.
I'm 9 years late, but I did want to congratulate Jeff Goldblum on his first child at the age of 62 in 2015. Oh, so that kid's got some big shoes to fill.
I wonder if he's like a little mini Jeff Goldblum. Like, I want to meet this kid.
Perfect hair. Yeah.
With perfect hair and like just the intonation of it all. I want to hear that kid talk. We also have Michelle Yeoh, who plays Madame Morrible. And she, as we have talked about her before, Everything Everywhere All at Once, Crazy Rich Asians also actually, Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon. And yeah. She's incredible.
She was the only one, if I'm being transparent, she was the only, I don't think it was a miscast, but she was the only one that took me out of it a little bit. And I love Michelle Yeoh. I love all her other work and the things I've seen her in. But in this, it was the one person where I was just like, something was not connecting with me personally. I don't know if it was her delivery, because she is very good at just being this sort of hard-ass stoic character when she needs to. I just saw her doing that in a not great Christmas movie called Last Christmas. She plays that.
Oh my god, like, that movie was so bad.
It's rough.
Anyway, yeah,
it's rough. Yeah, my mom loves it, so mom, if you're hearing this, I know you love that movie. I was not a huge fan, but Michelle Yeoh in that is kind of this hard-ass boss, very sarcastic, very smarmy. In this, because there's not a lot of humor behind it, and she's just playing the rude kind of professor, and occasionally she has these, but for some reason that was the only one where I thought maybe a different direction, but it wasn't like she was bad. It was just, she felt a little out of place to me.
Yeah. I liked her. I thought she was good. I mean, I don't think that she like knocked my socks off in this. I wouldn't like say that. I just thought
it's also
she
not
did,
that
like,
interesting of a character compared to everyone else on stage or screen in this, you know?
Yeah, it's definitely not yet. You know what I mean? Is what I would say. Like, it's not that big of a character yet. You're gonna hear more from her later, is what I would say. Jonathan Bailey plays Fierro. Ugh, this gorgeous, gorgeous man who is sadly gay, but whatever. He's done Bridgerton, a lot of British TV, including like Doctor Who, if you're a Doctor Who fan. And then, of course, a bunch of stage work, a lot of stage work, which shows. And like, he's very ready to, you know, dance and sing and do all the things. And he is such a wicked fan. Like, he was walking around New York City with a picture of Norbert Lear Boots, who's the original Fierro, on his shirt, and they have since done the thing that like you see happen sometimes with these celebrities where they start wearing shirts of each other. So then Norbert Lear Boots like tagged him in his shirt of Jonathan Bailey. It's been a whole thing. Anyway, they're fanning each other, and I love it. Like, there's such an homage here on this cast to the originals. Ethan Slater plays Bach, who is he got like a little bit more of a backstory in this version than on the Broadway version, but he's really fun. He's been in a few things, nothing like no huge roles. He's kind of been supporting, but he was in Marvelous Mrs. Maisel, which I've said before everybody should watch. The SpongeBob musical, which I would never watch. You would have to tie me down. And then Fosse Verdon, which I don't know if anybody, this again, it's probably got to be a theater kid to give a shit about this show, but it was so good. Michelle Williams, Sam Rockwell, like, oh, crush it.
So you'll watch Fuzzy Bourbon, but you're not going to watch the SpongeBob musical?
Absolutely not. Oh, I apologize for my co-host, theater fans. I understand that he doesn't get it. Marissa Bodie, I think actually, plays Nessa Rose. She hasn't done a ton of stuff yet. She did like write and perform her own short called You're Adorable, a few other little shorts. She's also mostly known and done stage work. She is disabled in real life. She will say that. I am not saying that. I do love that they cast a, you know, disabled person in a role of a person who in the film is disabled. The amount of like pushback and negative comments that she has had in the tour is kind of alarming. But she's like, I just think like there should just be awareness about like, we can perform.
Expand on this negativity. What are people saying?
Just negative things about her being in it, like not being, kind of like an affirmative action type of gig. Like they just gave it to her because she's disabled rather than her being talented, not having the experience to do this already. Like some of those kind of,
I mean, for what I just said about Michelle Yeoh and how it didn't land for me, not saying she's bad in it. For me, it wasn't connected. I thought the actress, Marissa's doing a pretty solid job in this.
I think she does a great job.
Yeah. She's standing next to acting giants. So I think for her only having had a couple roles, she wasn't distracting for me in any way. So
not at all. I thought she was great. I thought she was perfect for the role. I mean, I think she's perfectly cast, to be honest. And I think she, again, reflects the original musical very well. Like she plays it similar to the way that they kind of have the person play it in the musical. So I think
also, like,
I think it's great.
Not to, I'm sorry to like distract us, but like, you're never going to make everybody happy. People just need to chill the fuck out. Like, I remember when Welcome. The Rock did that Skyscraper movie that I don't think anybody saw anyway, but people were upset because in the film he is an amputee and he has, I guess, a prosthetic leg. And there were people up in arms on the interwebs about why did they not cast an actual amputee in this role? It's like, well, right. It's the Rock. Like, I'm going to, somebody out there is going to pay money to see a movie just because the Rock's in it. So it's like, people are always going to be pissed whether you're doing, and I'm not saying that's why they hired this actress. She's very talented, but it's like, can we just stop like sharing our opinions about every little fucking thing on the internet? Just go outside.
I also think, like, did you watch it and were you distracted by her really? Like, does it, she compliments the role. She's filling the role. Like, she does a good job. So you're reaching is what I'm saying. And I think it's pointless. I totally agree.
At the end of the day, would I have preferred to see The Rock as Nessa Rose? Yes. But this is what we got.
He would have done a great job. Yeah. He would have done a great job. We love you, Dwayne Johnson. Last one that I want to mention, there are many, many people to this cast who are incredible, but last one I want to mention is Mr. Peter Dinklage, who, of course, we love for a number of things, including but not limited to Game of Thrones, Elf, which actually I always forget that he's in that. I don't know why. And then I watch it and then I'm like, oh my God, he's so great at this. And then also Three Billboards Outside Ebbing, Missouri, which I think is, I wouldn't say a dark horse. It was an Oscar nominated film.
He was in that? I don't even remember him. I only saw it once. I don't remember him in it.
He's the guy who has a crush on Frances McDormand's character.
Okay.
Yeah. He's so good at it and sweet. I think he does such a good, anyway. And it's very different. Like, it's not, you know, it's not a Game of Thrones type of character. It's not even like an elf type of character who's an asshole. He's like genuinely a sweet guy.
That's what I was going to say. He's not afraid to play villains. He did it in X-Men Days of Future Past. I think he did it in one of the Transformers recently. So like he can play a bad guy too.
He does a great job playing bad guys, but this is like very genuine and sweet, this character. Yeah. So it's very different, and he's not like a pushover. I just mean he's just a sweet romantic guy, and it's cute. And a really dark film, by the way. So I mean, just anyway.
Yeah, that one, there's a reason I only watched it once, because it was a lot of emotions.
It's
over
heavy, but it's
period.
Good. It's good.
I was going to say, I can never hear Peter Dinklage and not think of that Key and Peele sketch where they're talking about Game of Thrones and they just refer to him as the Dinkles. Like the Dinkles, and they're talking about how good of an actor he is. Like, so I will always think of him as the Dinkles.
I don't think I saw that sketch, but I love that nickname. That's adorable. Okay, really quick before we throw down a spoiler warning, we're going to give you the plot summary in case you, for whatever reason, don't know what this is about by now and or haven't seen it. So Elphaba, a misunderstood young woman because of her green skin, which I almost did, by the way, and I couldn't find my green face paint, and Galinda, a popular girl, become friends at Shiz University in the Land of Oz. After an encounter with the wonderful Wizard of Oz, their friendship reaches a crossroads, which I thought was a solid spoiler-free summary, which I have made the mistake in the past of reading some spoilers. So we did all right. Okay, so here we are, guys. Turn around. Don't drown. It's spoiler time. Okay, let's do this. So quick production note. This thing, like, I think, again, I don't know that we needed a spoiler warning that much because this thing has made $700 million against $150 million budget, and it's still in theaters. So TBD how high that will go, but it's making bank. So,
do you know offhand where this stacks up compared to other musicals? I know that it's, like, one of the top performing non-Disney musicals, but I only looked at opening weekend. Is it... Right, it's close to a billion. It's like 3/4 of the way to a billion, so I assume it's probably going to be up there for highest grossing.
I mean, I didn't search it out, but I feel like I saw a headline about it being the highest grossing musical film so far. Yeah. I mean, hell yeah, this is great. This is a, I mean, I love musicals, but again, I think this is one of those that a lot of people can watch and not have to be a musical person. Basically.
I wanted to call out, like, right at the start, I got about, I think we were 20 or 30 minutes into this, and this was my first watch through of it, so I'm trying to take notes, but more just watch the movie and just to sit through and enjoy it for the first time through. Usually if we're doing a movie that I've seen multiple times, I'm taking notes the whole time, I'm doing my research.
Right.
But this I really try to sit and enjoy. So the first 30 minutes, I wasn't doing a ton of research, and I just remember thinking, wow, they're really pulling off, like, looking like they're really singing, because my one problem that I have with a lot of screen musicals, because I go back and forth on musicals. There's some that I really like. There's some that I don't. I would always rather see it on stage because I like that experience of knowing that it's happening live. So I had that feeling in this of, wow, they're really pulling off the lip syncing well. And then, of course, the second fact on IMDb when I'm doing my research is the two leads singing live on set. And that is just incredible.
And actually, a lot of the leads are. So it's not just them two. A lot of the leads are. What is recorded off stage are the ensemble numbers. Mm. And that is recorded in studio. And that is, again, a mix of people in the film and Wicked alumni. So it even actually tells you a little bit of why it sounds really full. Even though the on screen, there's only a handful of extras or, you know, 20 folks in the Dancing Through Life number, for example. So yeah, no, they're singing live, and it's not the first one to do it. The first one to do it was Les Mis with Hugh Jackman, Anne Hathaway, some of those, if you had seen that one before, but it's not consistent. And it certainly prior to that was not typical. I think also you have to see or have to realize that technology to record audio on set is so much better now. And I think that's what's part of what is making it possible. But fuck yeah, like they are singing crazy things live on set in an open, uncontrolled, non-acoustic environment. You know, it's wildly impressive.
That's my, when I watch a lot of musicals, the thing that takes me out of it is when you're clearly like they're doing these big movements with their mouth, and it's like, that's not, it just looks like they're being like a ventriloquist dummy. So I think this, you know, I was not shocked when I looked at that factoid, and I was like, okay, that's why I'm enjoying this more than I usually like musicals on screen. So
yeah, and I mean, Greatest Showman was an example of that, of like where some of that was a little bit off. And even Rebecca Ferguson's character, she actually does not sing her part in real life, the actress. So she had to fully fake it. And she has no way to identify with how she sings it. And that was one of the few where I thought, by and large, she did a good job of actually pretending to do it. But it's very hard, especially if you're just the actor and not the voice, and to lip sync to some of those other things. Like even old school, like My Fair Lady, Audrey Hepburn, her audio wasn't used. Her audio ended up getting cut, even though she did sing her parts. They had somebody else sing her parts. So it's very hard to line that up when you're not doing it live. So yeah, I agree. I think it's really cool that we see more of that now, and especially with these two, it's kind of crazy.
That's that's another treat for the video watchers, is whatever fucking thing I did with my mouth 2 minutes ago. So I'm gonna have to go back and watch that to see what I did with my tongue was going places.
Yeah.
So enjoy that, video watchers.
You see, if you weren't watching it already, now they're going to switch over. They're going to like mark the time and toggle over. You're welcome. Yeah. No, my only complaint, and this is a theater kid complaint, so don't judge me. It is not I'm not critiquing this person that I could not hold a candle to from a singing perspective. But in the opening number of No One Mourns the Wicked, there are multiple points at which you have a very hard time understanding Ariana Grande's very high soprano vocal parts. And first of all, the notes that she's hitting at those points are fucking insane. And she's doing an incredible job. And I'm trying to remember, because I haven't seen the musical in a hot minute, if that is something that is similar to the musical, where it's supposed to be just this like very intensely high part where you're not really enunciating that well. But that was my only critique of the whole thing, was there were a couple of parts where it was very, very high. And if you know the song, like, you know what she's supposed to be saying. But if you didn't know the song, you don't know what she's supposed to be saying. you know what I mean? Yeah. So I did notice that. And I don't know if that's like a live recording thing potentially as well, but it's nonetheless impressive that she can, you know, even hit these crazy notes, to be fair.
Speaking of that opening number, my first note that I had was, we don't, as a society, we do not break out into song when someone evil dies nearly enough. I know that in this, you know, spoiler, it's not an actual evil person, but I just feel like when a dictator, an evil person passes away, we should, as a society, just make a call starting today. We're going to break out into song and sing about it and have a good time, celebrate a little bit, you know?
Do we think that's how flash mobs started?
Potentially.
Because somebody felt the same way as you do now. And they're like, listen, this is a missed opportunity. Like, we need to like go into a full musical number at random. So let's just flash mob these fuckers.
There was that episode. Did you ever watch Buffy the Vampire Slayer back in the day?
Yes,
the
TV show? All of it.
Spoiler for the musical episode, but there is a musical episode and they don't explain at the beginning. They just, it's, oh, suddenly in season five, we're doing a musical episode.
Sidebar, did you like that episode?
Yeah, I enjoyed
it. Oh my God. Yeah. Obviously. I hated it. I was so mad. The theater kid in me was like, stop. Stop doing what you should not be doing. You know, like.
But like, I love that at the end of it, the whole reason, again, spoiler for a 30-year-old series, 25-year-old series, the reason that it happens is that Xander, like the dumbass character friend in the group, just found a demon and they were like, yeah, we can make the whole world be musical. And he thought it would be cool. That's the whole reason why it's happening. So yeah, maybe.
Which also, like, if you know Xander, checks out, by the way, like on brand for sure. But yeah, listen, I'm on board. Like, we can totally do this at random. I'm like, sign me up. We can flash mob. We can flash sing. I don't give a shit. Let's do it. I'm here for life to be a musical. It might make some of this feel better. Let's be honest. Let's just not make it Les Mis. Let's not make it Les Mis because.
Right.
That's brutal for everybody. You know what I mean? We need this to lift us up a little, is what I would say.
I'm going to draft up I'll start writing some lyrics for when Kim Jong kicks the bucket.
Oh my God.
I'm going to have a killer number ready. So.
It's true. Well, okay. So getting to back, actually somewhat related to the plot of, there's some shit going down in Oz. That's the point, right? So, well, not the point, but one of many points to this story, which is that, you know, Elphaba goes to school with her sister. She is mostly there to, you know, at least in the film, by the way, this is not true of the musical. In the film, she's there to watch over Nessa Rose. And she sort of incidentally ends up staying because she needs to stay with her sister. She's not intent. It's made very clear that she's not the, you know, beloved daughter like Nessa Rose is. She's kind of the black sheep, or should we say green sheep, because she's green. And yeah, and so she's just not treated the same way by her family and all these things. So but she loves her sister and her sister loves her. So there's that shining light. But she doesn't fit in, and it's because she's never fit in her whole life. And she sort of has like hardened herself to that reality is what we learn about her. And we have, you know, juxtaposed against her, her foil of Glinda is the exact opposite. She's had every, you know, luxury in life, every access that she has ever wanted, every privilege she could possibly need her whole life. She's incredibly spoiled, and she's your very prototypical, beautiful woman. She's, you know, fair skin, blonde hair, perfect hair, you know, petite, gorgeous, beautiful fashion, all the things, right? Meanwhile, we got Glinda, Elphaba wears a lot of black and has green skin.
Now, can I throw this out here right now? Because I was sitting here watching last night and thinking that Glinda is a combination of a
right
few
now,
different...
Galinda, don't get it wrong. We have to switch at the right time. Yeah.
Is a combination of kind of like three different characters in cinema. I think she's a little bit of Regina George, even if she's not intending to be as mean as Regina George from Girls.
She's not a full blown mean girl, but
she's
got
a little bit of Elle Woods from Legally Blonde, and she's a hell of a lot of Cher from Clueless, who's trying to help people, but she has a little bit of a selfishness to it. I've always wanted to get her way. Now, this book came out in 95, which would have been like a year after Clueless. I'm just throwing it out there, people. Like, maybe there was a little bit of Cher thrown into this.
Because I think that's a great call out, by the way, because I do think she's closest to Cher, for sure. Because what we can't say about Glinda is that she is a Regina George. She's not. She's not a full-blown asshole. She's actually not trying to hate people, as evidenced by the number that I referenced earlier. What is this feeling? She is unfamiliar with hating somebody. Mm-hmm. She has never loathed somebody before. So even though she is more privileged and maybe doesn't deign to spend all of her time with all of these people, she's not like hateful to people, and she's not an asshole. She's just very privileged and unaware of what it's like to be a normal fucking person. And so, yeah, I think she's very similar to a Cher, 100%. And then, yeah, and then Elphaba is just somebody who, you know, her rose-colored glasses are off. She doesn't feel like she's entitled to all this privilege. She knows why she's there. She doesn't think that she's ever going to... I wouldn't say that she doesn't think that she's smart or anything like that. She doesn't have like a self-esteem issue. I think she has a little bit of pessimism about what she can do with her life because of this limitation
sees the glass ceiling of like where her limits lie. And so she's just right. Not that she's given up, but it's just like, why try as hard when I know how this ends? Yeah.
I hear you. Yeah. And I think like that's actually evidenced later in one of the songs where she sings, "I'm not that girl," about Fiera. Mm-hmm. Fiero, for example, is, you know, it makes sense to her that she is not an option to him, right? She's not, she has the feelings are there. She recognizes that this is would have been a possibility for her, at least in her mind, if things were different, if she looked different, so on and so forth. So it's not that she is sad about it at moments, but on the whole, what I love about her is that that has been true to date. Right. It has been true to date that she doesn't have the right opportunity. She doesn't get to be who she wants to be because of this limitation of her skin, because of the way people treat her. But she fucking owns it. She's like, listen, okay, if I have to deal with this, then I have to deal with this. Like, I'm going to be edgy, snarky, smart, capable, and not give a shit about you. And the only times that you see her at all vulnerable are really for herself. It's like that typical, like, just don't let them see you cry kind of approach mm-hmm. to somebody who's being bullied or has a hard time. And she really embodies that throughout, to be honest.
Yeah. I think we can sort of just spin off of that into just... You know, we've talked in depth a little bit already about the actresses separately, but just the way that they play off each other. This is so, if you miscast this, if there's not chemistry there, this film does not work. The adaptation does not work. And just, there are so many moments in this, whether it is the beginning when they're sort of bickering and having these sort of passive aggressive arguments and leading into the actual full on, like you said, the loathing song, and then being more aggressive about it. Up until I think when the movie really like hits its stride, because I felt the same as I did about the musical, where the first 45 minutes or so, it's like, okay, this is good. It's fine. But when it really hits its stride is, I think, when they get to that nightclub bar scene and then they finally
dance bond. Through life. Yeah. Don't get twisted.
And yeah. That is just from then on, that moment they share on the dance floor where she's sort of like stroking her tears away. And it's this very emotional thing. In the wrong hands, that could have been very cheesy and dumb, but it plays really well. And the movie just is 10 out of 10 from that point on, I think.
Yeah. So Dancing Through Life is actually another really fun number that's led by Fiero, Jonathan Bailey's character, and leads into the Ozdust ballroom, which ends up being the Ozdust duet, which is what you're talking about, where it gets more emotional and they're sort of bonding. And what I love about that scene, and I totally agree, it's just like off and running from there. I mean, I love everything before that too, but it's just really off and running from there. And I think what's really notable is that Glinda immediately regrets giving mm-hmm. her the hat. You know what I mean? Like she thought it would be funny and silly. I don't think she it was a prank. It was, she did pull a prank, a mean girl, quote unquote prank. I would totally agree with that. But I think she did it in a semi harmless way. Like she thought it wouldn't be that big of a deal, and or that she wouldn't come. You know what I mean? Like she just thought one or the other would be true. But when Elphaba enters with the hat, she is super made fun of, and actually everything stops. You know, everything stops. Everybody stares at her. She can immediately feel all eyes on her, and you can tell she's just immediately embarrassed. But again, Elphaba style, fucking owns it. Doesn't want them to see her cry. Doesn't want them to see her be embarrassed, and just starts dancing in the weirdest fucking way possible. As far as you can tell, it's and Galinda, having immediately regretted it, as soon as she sees her on top of the stairs, you see it fall over her face, and she makes a split second decision to just have her back. And it's like, that's the turning point of, I did this, I'm responsible for this. I did not want her to be humiliated, and I need to help her.
The sequence of events that gets us there, like I said, I've seen the musical once, I've seen the movie once. It's a little confusing when I think about, just after you were talking about sort of how we got to this point. The reason she feels bad about giving her the hat is because she finds out that Elphaba did sort of a good deed for her in getting Madame Morrible to give her a wand and said, hey, I'm going to leave the university if you don't do this favor for her. The reason that Elphaba does that is because Galinda did the quote unquote good deed of getting Bach to ask her sister on a date. But that was just Galinda. Here's how you can read it. You can either say that was just Galinda using that as an excuse to get Bach away from her, of just, oh, look at that girl. You should go talk to her. It would make me really happy. You can see it as manipulative. The other thing would be to take it the positive way that we're sort of saying with Galinda, where maybe she doesn't want to hurt Bach's feelings, and she sees a way to help a student who's not getting as much love and attention as everyone else. So you can read it either way, but that sequence of events of what gets us to her feeling bad is all sort of, I think, based on how you read that first interaction. I don't know. Does that make sense?
Totally. I think, though, I would say, I think it's easy for us to, again, see Galinda at this point as kind of a mean girl for all the reasons that we've said. I don't think that's as mean as it seems, is the only thing I will say. And I think that's why Nessa Rose is grateful, and ultimately Elphaba becomes grateful as well, and then goes out on a limb for her, and that, you know, that chain of events happens. But I think it's not that weird to be like, hey, I'm not that interested in you. Like, maybe I maneuver this a little bit so you don't feel totally rejected, and this girl gets to go and you get to go and I get to do what I want to do. I think she saw it a little bit as like a win-win-win. I don't think she was trying to hurt anyone in that process, but I do think she was trying to deflect. Right. Like, I think she just didn't want to deal with no, thank you. You know what I mean?
That Bach still is under the impression that he's, at the end of the night, he's doing this to make Galinda happy. So they're going to end up together. And then when he sees her kissing Fiero is when he finally gives up and is like, oh, actually, yeah, I do like you. So, yeah, it all works out.
But I think like that. Yeah, it does. It all works out. And I think that's why it ends up being OK. But I will say, like, I can see how that's hurtful, but I also see how that's her not really ever saying I'm interested in you. You know what I mean? That's his interpretation. He has decided that he's doing this for her. She didn't say, this then means we will be together if you do me this favor, or, oh, I really love you and I wish I could go with you, but I really want this. She doesn't go so far as to say that. I don't think she actually misleads him. I think she's trying to gently nudge him a different direction. And of course, I think that's informed by like, being a woman, and it's very hard to tell people no, because you never know what the ramifications will be. So I tend to, in that situation, give her a little bit more grace. But I do appreciate that Fiero like calls her out. He's like, damn, you're good. And she's like, whatever do you mean? You know, so she's aware a little bit of how that could be seen and how she maneuvered that. So it's not like, you can see it both ways, I think. But I do think ultimately, to your point, it all works out. Nessa Rose has a wonderful night. She gets to have this great experience that she probably wasn't going to have otherwise. And regardless of how it happened, I think Elphaba is grateful. And you're right, reciprocates by, you know, Madame Morrible has no fucking interest in Galinda, because while she is, you know, popular and beautiful and, you know, has all the advantages in the world, she's not actually talented in this way. And I think that's the core theme for this particular thing, right? For sorcery, that's the important tether in this story, is that she doesn't have this talent. She doesn't have this magic, and Elphaba does. And so regardless of her skin color or that nobody likes her, they want her for her power. And I think you see that come to start to build Elphaba up. It really gives her that confidence of, it doesn't matter what I look like. I have this skill. I am a badass. I can learn this. And you see her really grow into that. And I think that's awesome.
I agree with that. I just, the one thing, the trope that I always, I don't even know if it's a trope. I'll have to go to the actual website and see if there's a trope with this title or something, but I hate when,
trope.com.
There is a website, tvtropes.com, right? Something like
that. I don't know what
it's a thing.
You can totally Google a trope for sure.
I despise when a character is getting bullied and mocked by the entire student body or group around them, and then it's like, well, they did one cool thing, and now we're all friends. I hate that she's being, and this is, you know, based on the source material, everyone's laughing at her point, but then as soon as the cool girl gets in there and they're doing it together, everyone joins in, and now we're all buddy-buddy.
I'm flashing back to you watching She's
On That. And, like, zaps them all with lightning.
Like, fun fact, this was his exact reaction when we watched She's All That, and then all of a sudden everybody likes Lainey Boggs because she's, like, the cool guy.
Nothing if not consistent. Yeah.
You know, has deigned to spend time with her, and he's like, what the fuck? Like, nobody likes her to be wise. Anyway, you are very consistent. I will totally give you credit for that. I agree, but I also think, yeah, I get why that trope is a little bit frustrating, but I do think taking tropes out of it and just like taking human experience into play, I think you sometimes you do find your people once you show who you are, right? Like once you show you really own yourself and get confident in yourself and you own your power or find your power, whatever that looks like. In this case, it's very literal, but she is not just the weird girl anymore, right? She has a talent. She has a skill. And before, she was like a little weird for various reasons. Yes, mostly because of her skin, but she also like did some weird shit. Let's be honest. She like blew up a whole fucking mural. She did some stuff that you're like, what?
And she's also, you know, she is sort of holier than thou in some of the early scenes when they're in the classroom and stuff. And she's sort of like giving this air of I'm smarter than everyone in this room right now. So I could see how they probably didn't.
And
like
it's
her.
A self-preservation mode, right? Like she doesn't want to try to make friends with these people because she knows that they're gonna, in her mind, gonna reject her in some way. So she's just aloof and pushes them away. That's her safety and self-protection mechanism, right? So nobody can get close to her even if they wanted to early on because she just has these defenses up. And I think at this point she is not necessarily letting her defenses down, but she is saying like, I have value and here is what it is. And we're figuring out what it is. And so, and whether it's the whole school and all of a sudden she realistically becomes popular, maybe not, but I do think you find your people when you are most authentically who you are and comfortable in your skin. So yeah. I love that for her.
I wanted to transition a little bit. Just talking about the nightclub scene, I wanted to talk about just how beautiful this film looks. I mean, I think it not only is it channeling the stage play and like a lot of the craziness that goes on there and the cool visuals that you get there, but it brings me back to seeing Wizard of Oz as a kid and how some of the stuff in that, like seeing color not for the first time on screen, but like when that released, obviously, and it brings a lot of that whimsical nature into this.
Yeah,
they do enough with I think the practical components where it doesn't feel
they do a nice mix
green screened or anything like that, but just the nightclub looks great. I love the waterway outside of the school. There's just some really
I love
pretty
the school
looking
actually I think it's yeah and to your point I think it's a good mix because of course some of it has to be CGI. But there's, and actually the director said that too, in the building of some of the sets, he was like, I wanted the cast to feel like this was a real place. Like Shiz was a place, like Oz was a place, like that they could really, you know, get into character and get into the environment. And I think that shows. It's very beautiful. I like the river as well. I like the views that they have. I like the just way that the classroom feels authentic. Actually, one of the classroom scenes that you were pointing to reminded me a little bit of like Harry Potter. And I was like, I just love this world building, you know, and
I was
all
like,
of that.
This is Hogwarts. I had that thought more than once.
Oh, 100%. And which like, who doesn't? Everything should be Hogwarts. It's beautiful. I thought it was great. And I agree. And I think you see that in Oz as well. And I think it takes a page out of the Wizard of Oz in that sense. And there's a lots of little, like if you do see it and, you know, no spoilers, want to go down the IMDb rabbit hole, trivia rabbit hole, there are a bazillion little homages to the Wizard of Oz here as well. And they did so well in the Wizard of Oz world building. And I think this complements that really well, but it modernizes it. To your point, I think it complements it. It modernizes it. It takes the really strong aspects of the musical on stage and brings it to life in a way that makes sense for the screen. Like one of the things that stands out to me is the wizard itself, you know, so it's a big, if you haven't seen the musical, is almost exactly that face that they show of him when they get to Oz, and he's, you know, basically puppeting the face and using the big voice and the mic and whatever. That looks almost identical, but they really build out the rest of the set around it in a way that complements it.
Yeah, like the flames around on the left and right, and then it kind of pokes out through like that curtain of like forestation or vegetation, whatever the hell it is. But that looked really cool.
And that's, again, bits of that are the musical on stage, and bits of that are actually also Wizard of Oz. If you don't remember, there were those big flame tufts as well. Somebody got set on fire on that set. So shit was for real, you know? And there's a lot of homages to that. Thankfully, no asbestos in this one, so that's good. but definitely a lot of homages to the production value, I would say, of the OG for
it's
sure.
It brings some of that fantastical wow factor to it. I will say it's not perfect. As always, you know, you guys know me, I'm going to complain about some of the digital effects. There's some stuff that the animal band playing at the night compared to how all the other animals in this look, you know, Peter Dinklage and all these other animal talking characters look great. But the band at the nightclub looks super digital. I didn't love that. I don't love the balloons popping in Oz.
I honestly didn't register it.
There's a few things that it's just like, well, that, I don't know why we opted to go that way. But yeah.
Yeah, I do think the other, because I didn't register the band in the club, at the Oz Does Ballroom, but I did notice a couple other, little CGI things that I thought were like, could be better.
The train was a little...
The train was a little I agree with that. I did really like the animals, and so one difference from the musical is that the conversation with her and Dr. Dillamon is between her and Dr. Dillamon in a classroom in the musical, and it's just the two of them, versus in the film it's a secret meeting of the animals coming together to like figure out what's happening in Oz. And I actually liked that because I felt like for the context of what is happening, that was actually a cool change, because you were like seeing how this really impacts the animal community inside of Oz. And it feels a little bit more real. And I think it also lends itself to complementing this, like, you know, dictator-ish type of story that they're alluding to. And with that additional context, I think it's a little better. But yeah, in that scene, all the animals look great. Like, they look very realistic. The conversation between her and Dr. Dillamon is really strong. And I think one of the things I really like about that is that he goes in quite a bit into what authoritarian tactics are. And he is yet again this like sentient, intelligent animal explaining to her that he knows what is happening to him and to others in this community. And he's educating her because he's brilliant. He's so smart. And I think it ties to a few other things. Like when the mural of the wizard is destroyed, you see that the teachers, the animal professors, the mural behind it, that's the original mural. So they used to be so much more respected in this civilization. And you see that that has slowly been degraded, and you get a little bit more context of how this has been a slow burn. This is a little bit of, you know, authoritarian tactics going, you know, coming together, coming to fruition over time. And I don't think it's lost on you that he's a goat telling her that the animals are becoming scapegoats.
Scapegoat. Yeah. Shouts to whoever thought it was worth putting that in. I thought that was funny. Like, I noticed that when the thing crumbled, when the thing crumbles and you see the image behind it and you're like, oh, there's animals in it at the university. Whoever put that in IMDb's trivia of like, did you note it? I'm like, that's just something that happens in the movie. That's not really trivia. That's just literally.
Are you talking about the mural part falling?
Yeah.
That part?
I was like, you don't need to put that in IMDb's trivia to be like, did you notice this? You know,
that
did
was
you notice
a thing
there was
that
a
happened.
Talking goat? This is in reference to blah, blah, blah. It's like, no. Also,
I remember that coming up with the musical, though, the scapegoat comment. That's the only reason I think of that, like, years ago. But I agree. Like, that's in the
I wonder if that was a literal thought from the writer.
I would imagine so.
Winnie Holzman. If that was, like, a conscious decision on her part to be like, he needs to be a goat. But I was also going to say, I'm going to assume the reason that that scene was so good and the animation was so quality, I'm just going to make the assumption that Andy Serkis played every animal aside from Peter Dinklage's goat in that
scene.
Facial expressions, voices, the whole.
I can roll with
yards.
That. Yeah. I can support that theory. I think it's a good one. He's the best, obviously. But I think, like, honestly, it was so hard for, I mean, not to go down a rabbit hole here, because I'm not trying to do that. But I watched this in a very different way than the last time even that I saw the musical, because it is such a parallel, I think, to what's happening in our world right now and in our country in particular. If you're tuning in from somewhere else, maybe you don't necessarily see it this way. But for me, it's a very like authoritarianism is taking over the society and just slowly barreling down on all the things that you find valuable, especially knowledge, especially education, especially diversity and knowledge and power coming from different places and different types of people and creatures and blah, 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 blah. And so watching this actually in theaters was weirdly hard for me. In this sense, I had a really good time because I love the musical, but all I could see was like Trump's America. You know what I mean? It was so hard to watch, but that's the story this is telling. I mean, really it is. This is the same kind of story that it is telling of this person coming in and centralizing power and trying to build this PR machine about their own skills, power, authoritarianism, blah, 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 blah. And she is rebelling against it. So like getting to like the moment that she really comes into her, she realizes who the wizard is. She realizes what they're doing to the animals. And she is an advocate truly for these animals and for Oz. You know, she doesn't want this to happen to her world, and she sees them as disingenuous, manipulative, evil, really. And she, despite the fact that it's going to make her look bad and crazy and all the things and the Wicked Witch, she still fights against them because ultimately she's like, this is the right thing to do. And I think that's what makes her, one, such a hero, and two, makes you really align with her at the end and have a hard time with Galinda, because you're like, Galinda, this is the moment where she has the opportunity to lean into like, I'm going to just do the right thing. And she falls back on her very typical, well, I don't want to rock the boat. This is the way
she wants to be liked.
She wants to be liked. She wants to get the opportunities. And she sees, you know, going this kind of route of anarchy and, you know, rebellion is not going to let her be those things. And that's more important to her versus for Elphaba. It's more important to do the right thing. And you see a real divergence here in this moment. And it's the biggest number that we see, you know, it's defying gravity. And it starts with this kind of rage at each other for what your values are. They're very upset at each other again of like, I hope you're happy now. And it's like said with this vitriol. And then by the end of it, they're just like recognizing how different one another are and just genuinely saying, I hope you're happy, but like, I can't do this with you. And it's so empowering for Elphaba, and you're like fucking cheering her on and you're fangirling for shit, or at least I am. But it's also a little bit sad because they're losing their friendship in the way that it was up to now, and you're seeing this side of Galinda that you're a bit disappointed by, to be honest.
Yeah, it's them going down two very different paths and sort of saying, hey, I really do hope that you find what you're looking for. I can't go with you. But yeah, so I think it's very intentional to your, I mean, you had a lot of really good points there, and you know, we've said multiple times the original source material is mid-90s. Musical comes out in I think 2003 or so. So to say like obviously this wasn't written with our current political state in mind, but it can apply hardcore.
Also, the authoritarianism and fascism are not new, so
yeah. I mean, I think they said in the last 2 weeks that one of the most Google searched or Googled terms was oligarchy. Like, a lot of people don't know what that is, and it's just, yeah, we're in this stage now where you're talking about power being centralized, and it's just well wherever the money is, that's who's going to be making the decisions.
Where's
and
the money?
We're on the all brink the of, as we're recording this, we're on the brink of this TikTok ban, and it's just like, well, you can't have this app unless one of these three billionaires owns it. So getting out of here. But I was going to say,
themes, I think these themes are common. As I mean, what you're saying is like, these themes are common. They're not new, and I think like that is in the material. Yeah.
The only thing I was going to point out to what we said about, you know, to what we said about Galinda making this decision at the end of wanting to be liked, I think that it's a very intentional line of dialogue early on in the film/musical where she says, why can't you just teach us history instead of harping so much on the past? I was like, that rings a little different in today's America of what we teach, what we don't teach. I know, again, not intentional to today's climate, but that comes out of her mouth. So she is, you know, she's got that lean to her, I'll say.
Yeah. And I think it's, what's the phrase? It's easier to go along to get along. And I think of her in that so much, and I think of Galinda so much in that phrase here of like, this is uncharted territory. This is like a rebellious, unpredictable path that paints a target on your back. It just does. Anytime you speak truth to power, that is what happens. And that is what Elphaba is doing here. And that's terrifying for somebody who does just want probably kind of a simple life. Like maybe they're ambitious, but they want it to follow this existing recipe, this existing procedure that they know. And she is nothing if not shrewd. It's in her own song, right? Earlier, where she's in Popular. Popular is one, a great musical number, but two, it alludes to a number of things that are very, 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 very true about politics and power. And she is not a dumb blonde. She's making choices inside of the system that she's in, and she does understand the system. You know, and she's realizing how corrupt this is. That is new information for her, yes, but she is falling back on her old understanding of the system of this is, I got to go this way because this is the predetermined pathway. This is easier. I got to find a way to work in the system, not outside of the system. So I don't think we should just assume that she's not going to do anything, but at this moment, you're concerned. You're concerned at going into the end of this film of like, is she just abandoning Elphaba? You know, there's a lot, there's a lot of thoughts and feelings here, but she's, I think I look at it that way, is one of them is going to work outside the system because they cannot align with the system the way that it is built. And one of them is going to go, what can I do inside of the system to survive and maybe do have impact here. And, but for the wizard and for Madame Morrible, that means turning Galinda into their puppet. And new branded witch, the good witch, you know?
Yeah. I will say that in that last 40 minutes or so, it was a little, it threw me off a little bit that we go through a good stretch of 15, 20 minutes without any songs. That was a little, as much music permeates this, and I might be misremembering, so sorry if I am, but it does feel like they meet the wizard. We get this short song from him and a really fun interaction with Jeff Goldblum because he's such a treasure. But then we kind of go from that moment until maybe it's because we know Defying Gravity is going to bring us home and just rock the house. So we don't need, but it does feel like there's a long stretch there where we don't have a lot of songs. And I don't want to say it took me out of it, but it did feel like the movie went down a little bit.
Yeah, it slowed a little. I think that's true. I mean, One Short Day does lead into A Sentimental Man in the musical pretty cohesively. And there is a little bit more of a gap there. There's a lot more dialogue there, I think. And that's where the screenwriter comes in from the book, like expands the book a little bit, the original book. So I do think that section gets a bit longer. A lot of that is set building, world building, it feels like. They're trying to show this space a little bit more. I love that the person who says, the wizard will see you now, is Stephen Schwartz. If you didn't know. And I also love that in One Short Day, which is like the wizard mania scene, they're getting ready and all these things. We get the cameo of the original Elphaba and Galinda, Idina Menzel and Kristen Chenoweth, if you didn't know. And I say that because I don't think anybody in my theater knew. And I was very upset about it.
I mean, I know Adele Dazeem. I don't think I would recognize her on the street, but I know the name thanks to John Travolta. So I do know Adele Dazeem. But Janelle caught it. And she was like, oh, that's Kristen Chenoweth. Yeah. And then we looked it up and it's those two. I think it's also the guy that played Fiero. So they work in a lot of cameos there, which is cool.
They do. And they change the song slightly because like One Short Day is this one specific song. They change it and like they give her some specific notes. They give Idina Menzel, the original Elphaba, her original Defying Gravity note. They don't hit it with the same oomph, but they give her the big like trill again. Mm. It's like an homage to that. She also does an homage where she's like falling and melting as the Wicked Witch. So that's an homage to the Wizard of Oz. So this is just a great scene of like, bringing all the OGs back, really showing some respect to those originals, but then going into A Sentimental Man, which was originally done by Joel Grey on Broadway, also a gem, also incredible. But I liked that Jeff Goldblum did feel like a screen equivalent. Like, I don't know how to describe that, but he did feel like a good translation of a Joel Grey. And it was just the right amount of smarm, is what I would say. Because you do not quite realize at the beginning that he's going to be not great. But he has enough of that smarminess to him that you, it, when it goes that way, you're like, yeah, checks out. And I think that's, I was asking people who hadn't seen it before. I was like, did you see that coming? And they're like, not necessarily, but like, yeah, I could see it from Jeff Goldblum. I can see it. And so I think he was the right person for that. And then I agree. It kind of slows quite a bit down. And then you build up to the Defying Gravity scene, which is like,
yeah, oh, the finale.
Fucking incredible.
To your point about this is meant to be, hey, we're going to take 20 minutes and go grab another drink or snack or whatever and then come back. It is meant to be a climax. So it delivers. Yeah.
It so delivers. And this is one of the things I will say. As much as Ariana Grande pays homage to Kristen Chenoweth's portrayal of Glinda, and she does, and she tweaks it a little bit and all of that, she does an incredible job. This is where I feel like, especially, and she's done it a few times throughout, but this is where I think Cynthia Erivo really makes Elphaba hers. Like, this is her Elphaba. This is not an Idina Menzel's Elphaba with this song. She changes this song significantly, not to where it's not identifiable. She doesn't completely change the structure of the song, but the way that she sings it is so much different, and it has umph and heart and heaviness in different parts, and it's different enough that it feels wholly original to her and not just somebody trying to copy an Idina Menzel, a Shoshana Bean, some of these early players of this performance. And yeah, she just fucking kills it. It blows your mind.
I think they may, and I grant, like, I did not recognize this on my own because, again, one time of each, but I had read and it felt as I was watching it, I was like, they stretch this out a little bit, like the finale, from when that song starts to the actual conclusion of the film, it felt longer. Yeah, they take little breaks, they add in, I think, a couple little extra lines or a couple lyrics, and so it works. Like, it really fucking works. To just, we know how popular this song is, no pun intended. We know how strong of a closing and a moment this is meant to be. So this is our climax of the film. Let's stretch it out to like a 10 or so minutes before we wrap this thing up for the next one.
Yeah, I think it has to hit a little bit harder in the film version because we're not going to come back from an intermission in 20 minutes, to your point. So I do think they milked it a little, but I thought they milked it in an appropriate way. It makes sense for what's happening. They're kind of being chased, this, you know, this action sequence that complements it really well. And when she's choosing to break out literally and go fly for the first time that you really see it, it makes perfect sense. And if you're me, you're fucking sobbing. You're like cheering, sobbing, you know, you're like, this is amazing. And so I was like, but I don't think anybody in my theater had seen the musical. So I was like over there by myself, fangirling and freaking out. And I'm like, poor Skylar sitting next to me. And I'm like looking at him and I'm like trying to like see his reactions. And he's like, I mean, I love it, but like, I don't know what you want from me. And I was just, yeah. Anyway, it's incredible. I think even if you don't have that history, it's just a mind, her performance is mind-blowing there.
Shouts out to those of us who, especially something that we've already seen, you spend most of the movie watching the other people you're watching 100%. To see their reactions. Shout out to all y'all out there.
Have you ever seen the Kermit meme about that, where it's like the Kermit the Frog puppet like folded and looking kind of sad, and it's like me anytime I try to show something that I love to someone who's never seen it before and they don't react? I am that Kermit in that moment every time. I'm just like, but love this the way that I love this, please. It's okay. You don't have to. It's fine.
I've got one other question for you just to sort of bring us home here. Did it break your heart when Glinda referred to the library as the book place? Did you cry in the theater this time? I know you cried in the musical. Did you cry in the theater this time?
I teared up. Yeah. It gets me every time. The disrespect, okay? the disrespect. I teared up in this movie so many times though. Like, I'm not a big crier, y'all, I promise. But every now and then it comes out and all the feelings were had in this one. And yes, I find that deeply offensive. You're right.
I mean, at least she knows what a library does. She gets the general concept of it, you know?
Does she? Yes. I mean, she goes there to meet the boys. You know what I mean? Yeah. She's there for the sequence of dancing through life, let's be honest. But it's fine. Whatever. I'm not judging you. Just judging you. It's different. Okay, so what's your rating?
For a first time through, coming out, even if I think my rating would be the same whether I'd seen the musical or not. I think this is really enjoyable. It's very fun. It's very funny. The comedy lands, I think, without exception. There was nothing that really didn't hit for me comedy wise. I'm always going to have a little bit of eye rolls with when it comes to musicals, with just when there are the people
like
singing,
they're just busting out into song for no reason.
I like the concept of musicals. I don't like it when I can tell that it's they're doing the very big mouth movements that aren't aligning with what's coming out of their mouths at all. Little things like that will always bug me with musicals, but the fact that they sang the majority of this live on set just made it so much more enjoyable. So. And there's also just to the one time compare it to the stage play. There's so much more you can do when you transfer to cinema and people have their preferences. You do miss out on hearing them sing live to appreciate the fact that you are getting a one-off performance of this is happening with you in the room. You miss out on that. But when you go to the screen, you can do things like in Loathing where they're cutting away to the different classrooms they're sharing like doing different movements when they're in Oz and he has the little miniatures and they're walking through that. There's things in cinema you can do that just makes it a totally different experience. Not to say one's better than the other, but at the end of the day, I loved it. I thought that the leads were incredible. Maybe a couple things. I don't know what you can do to change anything about the source material, but I'm not going to complain about any of that today. So I'm going to give it like for a first watch an 8.5. I had a great time. It might go up, it might go down, but I think right now 8.5.
Yeah. Mine's like a 9.5. I don't know that I really need to explain that at all because of
I think you just spent 80 minutes explaining it.
I think I explained it for 80 minutes and with a costume and with props. And I'm very sad I couldn't find the playbill. I also have the full score for piano that I also couldn't find. So I'm obsessed and it shows. And I loved it. I thought they did it justice. I was, like I said, I was nervous. I wanted it to be great, but I would say I was just trepidatious. I didn't think it would be bad. I didn't think it would be good. I just was not sure. And yeah, I think it's a solid 9.5. I had a great fucking time. Go see it for sure. Deserves all the awards as far as I can tell. All right, fam. Well, thanks for joining us. Highly recommend these cocktails. These are really good. Highly recommend this movie. Come back next
week. Save this tiny ass little bit for our closing cheers.
Because I know. I keep like when they're really good, I don't ever have enough left. And so I got a budget. Exactly. So I switched to water a while ago. So yeah, I got a little bit left. Highly recommend. Come back next week for more Oscar noms. We're going to let you know what that one is. Fun fact or not a fun fact. I apologize. We're going to come back with Oscar noms later because they have been delayed due to the fires in LA. So just keeping it real. We knew this one and know this one is going to be nominated. So that's how it ended up as our first Oscar nom of the month. We will let you know what the next one is going
to be. Yeah, for what it's worth, we're recording this in mid-January to try and get ahead of, you know, all the stuff coming. So
My birthday's in February. I'm going to be very busy. I'm sorry. We will have more for you. So come back next week for TBD Oscar film. But for now,
follow us on our socials at We Drink and We Watch Things, throwing up reels on Insta, YouTube. I did notice we've got good number of subscribers on YouTube. I'm pretty. Yeah. Man. So thank you guys.
Our YouTube homies.
Yeah, I'm glad that the video is paying off. So again, you'll get to see Mackenzie's hat today. You'll get to see my sugar and my mustache, the colors of our drinks, all that good stuff. But if you're not a video person, we appreciate a like, a subscribe, follow, all that good stuff on wherever you're listening to podcasts. You can also always email us. We drink and we watch things pod@gmail.com with suggestions. If there's other Oscar-nommed films that you really want us to cover this month or any suggestions for future months, send them our way. We're open to any and all feedback that is positive.
Yeah, no constructive criticism. You just tell us how great we are. That's all we want to know. No, I'm just kidding. All right, homies. For now, go have a drink and watch a thing. Cheers.
Cheers.
Literally just enough for that last drink. Perfect.
popular.